Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello and welcome back to the New Books Network Media and Communications Channel. I'm your host, Monica Wilkie. Today we're going to be talking to Eileen Lahan about her new book, Microblogging Memories, Weibo and Collective Remembering in Contemporary China. Eileen, thank you for joining us. Hello and welcome back to the New Books Network Media and Communications Channel. I'm your host, Monica Wilkie. Today, we're going to be talking to Eileen Lahan about her new book, Microblogging Memories, Weibo and Collective Remembering in Contemporary China. Eileen, thank you for joining us.
Hi. Hello, everyone. It's glad to be in this program.
Fantastic. So before we get into the meat of the book, can you just give us a brief bio about yourself?
Okay, so I grew up in China, and I spent a few years studying Hong Kong and before I moved to the United States, and I got my PhD at University of Pennsylvania in the school of in Edinburgh School of Communication. So after that, I started to work on this book based on my dissertation. So I'm now teaching at Michigan State University. So that's briefly about me. So I'm interested in social media, collective memory. So it's basically a critical approach to the understanding of social media, especially in contemporary China.
So you just mentioned then a couple of your interests. Is that what drew you to the subject matter and what ultimately led you to writing this book?
Yes, absolutely. So this book came directly out of my dissertation project. So I want to study how people remember public events in the age of social media when everything was changing so quickly. And it seems that everybody can become a journalist reporting what is happening around them. So that is the thing that drove me to this research. So I'm a heavy social media user, especially Weibo. So that is a Chinese microblogging platform, as you know. So after about a year, just looking around on this platform, and I find it's really fascinating. So especially the year of 2011, it was a very eventful year, both in China and in other parts of the world. So, you know, at that time, Japan had an earthquake, and followed by a tsunami and the failure of the nuclear power plant. So unlike, before, I first got this news from Weibo, the Chinese, sources. So when I was just randomly browsing, it was early in the morning in the U.S., but still I got a lot of information coming in, just like flood So there were lots of reports from Chinese media, which I can read, and also a lot of firsthand information coming from Japan, from the Chinese, and from the correspondences. So what I found interesting at that time was that together with the developing news, the latest information was still flooding in, people began to talk about similar past events, such as the 2008 earthquake in China and also the Indian Ocean tsunami, or like the nuclear power plant accidents like the Chernobyl, even the atomic bomb in Hiroshima. So people were making comparisons of these similar incidents, past and present. While on Weibo, they were also posting videos, images, and words to remember the current event. So this is how I began my project. So there is the one general interest, but there's also one particular event that drove me to that project. So even though I was quite new at that time to the platform, I was still trying to figure out some of its features. But following this triple disaster in Japan gave me an opportunity to think about how I might be able to build up a connection between social media, the transformation of journalism, and also the practices of collective remembering.
So in your personal experience, this time that you just described in 2011, was mm-hmm. that sort of the very first time that you became aware of this parallel time when people were both remembering similar events and also grieving for what was happening and keeping up to date with current events?
Yes, exactly. Because at that time I was still quite new to that platform, so I was still figuring out how to use certain features of that. So, conventionally we would think that social media platforms like that would be a convenient platform for people to report what they see and hear around them immediately. So it's not so much about using those platforms as a tool for creating memories or collective remembering practices. So that was the first time I kind of realized these parallel that's going on the same platform.
You've used the phrase collective remembering a couple of times. Can you just give us, for those who may not know, just a definition of what you mean by that phrase, collective remembering?
Yes. So, initially I intended to use the term collective memory because that is what most academic studies will use to describe this social remembering of the past. But I want to use remembering to specifically highlight the nature of it being a process. So it's always ongoing. So the memory making, it's always ongoing. It's not, so what we remember is not something that's out there, but it's always in the making. So especially for the contemporary events or issues. Everything is changing, and so the memory could also change just in the next few seconds. So this is why I prefer to describe it as a process.
You did have a section in your book that sort of feeds into what you were just describing there quite well, and it's titled How Remembering Leads to Forgetting. So the way you're just describing it as a process, how do you sort of feel it goes with the nature of social media, just this constant onslaught of information? So while people are remembering because of the pace of it, do some events just fall off the radar?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so definitely. So that section was not in my dissertation, so I added it when I was writing this book. So I feel that so the nature of social media is pretty much welcoming this ongoing, this instantaneous feedback and updates. It's not so much about preserving. And, you know, in these days, something happens, so like a hot topic out there can disappear just in a few days, maybe a week, and then nobody would talk about that. But in this book, I described how people were still trying to grasp something out of that. These features of social media do lead to some kind of forgetting. So even though in the practices of remembering, so for example, so we talk about how people instantaneously start to commemorate those who like lost their lives in a disaster. But as the days went on, so this commemoration became a sort of formulaic practices. So you can just post like a candle emoji, or like saying a few words like rest in peace, or put some flowers and stuff like that. And then your posts get reposted by other people. And then just after a few days, I mean, we don't seem to care about the core of the event. So there's all kinds of these commemorative messages out there on this platform. I think especially in more recent events, so I see that people learned these kind of practices. So, and it's getting more and more formulaic. So as if you post some candles or flowers or RIP, and then you're free from other obligations to remember these people. So in that sense, this remembering could actually lead to forgetting. So that's the downside of the collective remembering practices on social media. That is that I added to my study.
So it's interesting what you brought up then, how you said it's formulaic, because I think that's indicative of many social media platforms, not just Weibo.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Do you think that with these new technologies and just the immediacy of it now, is having people basically post something and then forget it basically just a side effect that we just have to wear, basically that it's better if people even just have a cursory knowledge and forget rather than not know about an event at all?
Can you repeat the question again?
Yeah, sure. So with people, you know how you're saying it's very formulaic, they just say rest in peace or
yeah,
a candle. Mm-hmm. And that can lead to people forgetting about victims quite quickly. Do you think that that's a trade-off? Is it better for people to have a very formulaic sort of commemoration and move on than not know about an event at all?
Well, yes, of course. I mean, at least it shows that, well, at certain period, even it's a very short period of time, there's a group of people who care about these victims or care about the development of the event. So it's better than not knowing that because, well, at some point, I mean, talking about certain event could become taboo or could be banned by the higher authority. So even if there's a even if people remember these things at in a very short period of time, I think it's still worth doing it. So even if, these kind of formulaic memory would lead to a quick forgetting, I still think it's better to have that than having nothing to remember.
You did just mention then about how subjects can be taboo and the higher-ups can get involved. Has mm-hmm. Weibo fallen victim to censorship much?
Yes, it's pretty much. So especially in recent years. So in the beginning, I think the higher authorities, the officials, didn't quite catch up with this new phenomenon. So it was not very easy for them to get in. So when something exploded on Weibo and it was spread to a larger public quickly, so the officials usually reacted very slowly to this situation because they were not so used to that. But in recent years, I think, so based on my observation, I think they are getting more and more accustomed to it. And so these censorship is getting more sophisticated. So it's not just about blocking some user's account or deleting some posts. So these are very basic practices of censorship. But now I think what is remarkable is that the official institutions, including some official media, they are actively participating in the conversation with the ordinary people on Weibo. So in that way, they can voice their opinions and they can shape the public opinion in a way they want. So it's much more sophisticated than just closing down some people's account.
I'll just read a quote that you wrote. You said, quote, "Journalism benefits from the digital age and global network society in which different groups of individuals collaborate to tell a story. The culture of journalism becomes more collaborative, responsive, and interactive, privileging the role of the individuals," end quote. That just goes to the point that you were talking about then about how media outlets are interacting with individuals and mm-hmm. how the authorities are sort of trying to catch up to that. Mm-hmm. What do you see the role of citizen journalism moving forward? Because it's a phrase that we hear quite a lot in relation to media studies.
Yes, of course. So I did mention very similar activities of citizen journalism. So even though we don't use this term quite often in the Chinese context, because in some way this word citizen suggests something that the authority doesn't like. So usually people would just use like a very Chinese term like self-medium. So it's basically very similar. But and this self-medium is much wider. So the meaning is much wider than citizen journalism. Yeah, but I did talk about the individual-based journalism practices, especially in Chapter 3, which I focus on these multiple forces of control and the resistance work together to shape the meaning of public events. So especially during the earlier years of Weibo, it was quite an optimistic and a celebratory atmosphere on the platform, and people were celebrating the potential of Weibo in empowering the individuals so that everybody can become a journalist. So as long as you have a phone in hand, you can basically report whatever you see. So for example, like I mentioned in Chapter 2, this high-speed train crash. So that was actually first reported by people who just walked by and they saw, well, they saw the train slowing down, and then was eventually there was a crash. So it was considered as the victory of the individual, of the individual authorities. I mean, as a journalist from the mainstream media at that time, basically, you didn't get the exclusive story because these things are already on the social media. So you have to, sometimes contact those individuals who were on site to get more information so that you can write your report. But at the same time, I think Weibo is also a quite hierarchical place. These ordinary individuals, they also need the authority of the journalists to help them to spread these words out. So if you are like, so just like me, for example, if I have like a few hundreds of followers, so my voice couldn't get that far. But if I, well, at mention some famous journalists or media or even celebrity, so this could be a big deal. In this way, I think there's a mutual beneficial relationship between the individuals and the, traditional or mainstream journalists. So in some way, they are working together to bring things up rather than competing with each other to get the story out.
A lot of the time when people talk about the state of the media these days, they sort of look to citizen journalism and bemoan the decline of journalism. Mm-hmm. But the way you just described it then, you sounded a lot more optimistic, saying that citizen journalism is in a way giving power back to the individual. And if they're at mentioning people and if they happen to be at the site of an event, it's more of a reciprocal relationship as opposed to fighting. Would that be accurate?
Yes, at least this is my observation during that time when Weibo was still in its early or what I call the golden age.
Now, you mentioned the train accident before then. That was the 723 accident, yes?
Yes.
Can you go into just a little bit more depth about that? Because I found that one of the most fascinating parts of the book, the way you sort of pick apart how that unfolded. So can you just go into a little bit more depth about that?
Yeah, so you want me to describe that accident in greater details?
Yes.
So that accident was very remarkable in the history of Weibo because that was regarded as the very first major disaster in the age of Weibo. So that accident happened in 2011. So it was in July 23rd. So that's why we call it 723 accident sometimes. So the accident was between two high-speed trains, and it killed 40 people and with about 200 injuries. So that's a very big number. So what is very special about the accident, I also mentioned in the book, is that from the very beginning, even before the crash of the two trains happened, it was recorded. So people have already posted the pictures to Weibo. It was a stormy night, some people captured a running train slowing down. And then just a few minutes later, it was hit by another train coming. So the very first image that was captured by people, that was the very first image about this accident that people captured just with their phones. So soon, the first post calling for rescue was posted to Weibo. as the crash happened. So in that sense, every detail of the accident has been recorded. So at these beginning years of Weibo, people were very much concerned, and also they would like to, they would like to use these new tools to try to, I think that there's a way that people were trying to kind of write their own history into that. What also makes people so angry about after this accident is that the next day when the news were full of this accident and the following up of everything, so people found that the damaged train cars were immediately buried without any efforts of preserving the evidence for further investigation, or even there may be still passengers alive waiting for rescue there. So people began to question, so why the rush? So what were the officials, like the Ministry of, that is the Ministry of the Railways. So why were the officials trying, what were the officials trying to hide from the public? So people were very angry about this, and they started to pose their questions, concerns, and the criticism. And later at that night, at the press conference, the spokesperson of the Ministry of Railways said something very inappropriate at that time. So that also triggered another wave of anger. So people were criticizing the officials for not respecting the lives of individuals. They were not doing what they should be doing. And also they were questioning why the Chinese government is trying to promote its high-speed rail technology to the rest of the world, even though this the safety issue is still kind of like unresolved. The evidence would be that crash. So that was suspected to, due to the failure of the communication system. So there are a lot of questions emerging from this single event. So, and again, just like the previous, the earthquake in Japan, people started to compare this event with the previous ones, and they were, and at the same time, they were immediately commemorating the victims, especially some individuals who had very touching stories being shared on Weibo. So, so this single event, there's a lot of issues about information transparency, about the government responsibility, and things like that were going on. So that is why it became so, this event became so important to look at. And this also, I think, shaped the ways in which how people understand later events and how they remember later events.
Because this was one of the first times, you said the first major event in Weibo's history, and people mm-hmm. were asking questions of the authorities. Do you think that has forced officials and higher-ups to be more transparent in their communications because they know that they can't get away with it?
To some extent, yes. To some extent, they have to provide the information. For example, at the very beginning of the accident, there were a lot of information, but not all of them are very accurate. So it was the responsibility for the government to provide credible information to the public. So, I mean, they were trying to do that. But I think for this particular event, because it was very sensitive, it involved these high-ranking institution, the Ministry of the Railways. So it's very difficult to for these authorities to shift, to make a shift like 180 degree. So what I see, so after this particular accident, was actually more censorship of these related topics. So you can talk about some aspects of the accident, like the victims, the stories of the victims, or you can still commemorate them. But all these questions regarding these high-speed railway technologies, or the possible corruption in the Ministry of Railways. So these are the questions that are later banned. But for some other incidents, I think we did see at some point there were certain kind of transparency between the governmental officials and the public, but it's still quite limited in some way. Because of the existence of Weibo or similar social media platforms, I think now the official authorities, so they realize that it's impossible to hide everything. So even though they want to censor a certain aspect of these of a certain event, so they have to at least be transparent at some point or to a certain extent.
With that accident as well, you said that a part of it was that they were selling this technology to other countries.
Mm-hmm.
How has the implementation of Weibo affected how China interacts with the world, and possibly also how the world has viewed China? Has there been any influence in that space?
Yes, I do think so. In chapter 6, there's a chapter called Global and Local. So it's mainly about this global scape of journalism and memory making on Weibo. So that could that also addresses the issue of how Weibo facilitate the communication beyond China. So I talk about the group of overseas Chinese communities. So they were now able to share what is happening out there in their communities back to China more frequently and instantaneously. There's also more and more sort of comparisons made between China and the other countries. So, for example, just like the previous accident, the high-speed train crash. So people start to talk about how Japan handled similar accidents very carefully and successfully. So not like this one. And they started to talk about how after the 9/11, the U.S. government and the public spent many years to kind of investigate and also try to remember everyone who died in that tragedy. So there's always a comparison going on. And more recently, however, I feel like there is a growing trend of nationalism beyond the Chinese state. So, for example, like whenever there is an accident or disaster happened overseas, like a few years ago, there was an earthquake in New Zealand. And so people start to talk about how the Chinese government reacted so quickly, and they dispatched flights to rescue the Chinese people, the Chinese citizens, and things like that. So that became evidence of a powerful, strong motherland that is able to care and save its citizens when in difficulty. And also in terms of this international flow of news, so I do see there's a lot of foreign media organizations and also even celebrities. They were having Weibo accounts. So, well, of course, it's translated into Chinese. I think there's a team for them to do that. But, I mean, it becomes a major way for them to communicate. So, like a sports stars or like celebrities. So, it becomes a major way for them to communicate with their Chinese fans and things like that.
I think that was very interesting what you just said then about the New Zealand earthquake and how they were dispatched to help the Chinese citizens. I wasn't aware of that. So in a way, it's like what you just said then, Weibo is making China and the Chinese more globalized and more globally aware, but at the same time, they're more connected to their own citizens in a way.
Mm-hmm.
So
go ahead.
No, did you have anything else to add from that?
Yeah, I just want to comment that. So this is a very nice tension that's been going on. So it's more globalized, but at the same time, it's a kind of an apparatus of a growing nationalism. So yeah.
In the book as well, you discuss the idea of cosmopolitan Chinese. Is that similar to what we were just discussing?
In some way it is. But I use that term to address another aspect of this idea of global Chineseness. So I use two specific examples in my book. So when I was doing my research, so there was the 10th anniversary of the 9/11. So at that time, a lot of Chinese people were writing on Weibo and they were talking about how they reacted to the news when they first heard that 10 years before. So at that time, when they first heard the news, a lot of people were actually applauding. So they were celebrating. So in that sense, now 10 years after that, when people look back at what they did before, so there were a lot of the feeling of shame on that. And they were saying that at that time, they were so indoctrinated by these anti-American sentiment, these anti-American propaganda. And so basically what they want to do 10 years after that was to kind of reflect upon that. And they were arguing that we shouldn't look at these kind of tragedy in this kind of narrow-minded way. We should be embracing these shared emotion and this shared, so we should have the empathy over the suffering people, even though, ideologically, you don't agree with them, or you're from different nations and they are in conflict or something. And also another example was more recent. So that was in 2012. So there was a major territorial dispute between China and Japan, and also because of the history. So there was a long time hostility toward the Japanese for many Chinese people. So during that territorial dispute, so there were a lot of protests on the street, and also people were doing a lot of violent things like vandalizing the Japanese owned shops or smashing the Japanese brand cars. So doing that kind of thing. So these behavior were highly criticized on Weibo. So those people who criticized these, they cited the past event like the Cultural Revolution that happened in the 60s and 70s. At that time, it was so they understood these kind of violence as irrational, and they argue that as Chinese citizens, we shouldn't be allowing these kind of things to happen, because that is not only the shame of the nation, but it also shows that the Chinese people were still very xenophobic and sometimes irrational just because of this historical hostility. So they were arguing that we should be rational, we should respect the private property of other people. So we should be really to embrace the idea that this narrow-minded, militant nationalism is not a good thing. So in this sense, I think at least in the first few years of Weibo, it was cultivating this idea of thinking beyond the national boundary and beyond these nationalistic sentiments.
It's quite amazing with those two examples that you just gave, particularly with 9/11 and just how quickly opinion has changed. I mean, a decade isn't very long. So to go from celebrating it to when it first happened to 10 years ago saying, well, hang on a minute, maybe it wasn't a great thing. It's phenomenal how much the opinion shifted in a relatively short amount of time.
Yeah, and I think there was a kind of shift of opinion largely due to the early participants of Weibo. So basically in the beginning, Weibo was kind of marketed as a media platform. So their operators or their management team intentionally invited a lot of journalists and also some famous scholars and those people in the intellectual communities to be part of this community, to be part of Weibo. So I think a lot of these people at that point, they were what I call the most liberal-leaning group of the Chinese Weibo, of the Chinese people. So basically, most of these people were arguing that as a Chinese, we should be catching up with the Western world. So especially learning from their political system, to learn from their level of civilization and things like that. So this kind of mentality, it's not something new. It's been there for like a century. So ever since China first encountered the major Western powers, so it's not something that just happened when Weibo emerged. It was always there, but it was Weibo that actually amplified their public influence. So I think this is why we have seen this major shift of this opinion. That was the earlier age of Weibo. So in recent years, a lot of these people, they either quitted Weibo, or some of them, their accounts got blocked because of their critical opinions about certain issues, or just because of their being so outspoken. So there's also a changing trend on Weibo as well.
A few times you've said that in the earlier days of Weibo, and that you wrote this book during the golden age of Weibo, you just briefly touched on then that a few people have left because their accounts have been blocked because of censorship. You also discussed the emergence of competitor WeChat. How do you see Weibo moving forward? Do you think it will continue to decline, or will gain influence, or are other competitors going to basically outmaneuver it?
Well, WeChat, it actually emerged at about the same time as Weibo's golden age. So that was around 2011. In recent few years, it became a very popular app. And I think its active user is much more than that of Weibo now. These two things, these two platforms are very different. Weibo, as I mentioned, is public. So it means that you can see whoever posted there. You can see what is going on. Basically, it's very much transparent. So as long as those posts were not deleted, so you can basically see other people's comments, and you can see what's going on. Also a lot of these followers on Weibo, so my followers, for example, are not the people who I know in my life. So it's basically a connection between strangers. So although you would have connections with like your coworkers or friends, but a lot of these connections are strangers. The WeChat is a very different system, so it's pretty closed. So I use the term public square and a private salon to show the difference, which is also what the Weibo operation team was actually making that distinction. So as a private salon, you basically hear what your friends were saying, what the people you invited were saying, and also your conversation in this small room will not go beyond that small circle. And what is interesting is that the things you posted, so WeChat has also a function called Moments, where you can basically share your personal stories and life, just like Facebook. But what is interesting is that the thing you share on Moment can only be viewed by your friends. And if someone left a comment there, so for example, if I check my friend's Moment post, I would only see the comments of our mutual friend. So I won't see other people's comments if that's not our mutual friend. So it's a pretty closed system. So in that way, in terms of public influence, I think well, WeChat still cannot compare with Weibo. Well, it's so like in some more recent events, well, sometimes people start to talk about it on WeChat, but it was when, well, but when it was posted to Weibo, so that was the time it gets real public influence. So if this conversation is kept on WeChat, well, these sharing repos, and these are quite limited. And it's very hard for you to hear different opinions because you wouldn't see them unless you have a mutual friend with another user. So basically what you will see would be more likely to be those who are similar to you. So in that sense, you don't really get a lot of diversity in terms of the opinion. But WeChat has its strengths in many ways. It's now becoming a tool where you can do almost everything from calling a taxi, ordering a meal, or paying your bill or something like that, which is too complicated. And, well, I mean, I've been away from China for many years, so it's really hard for me to catch up. But I think, well, some people argue that Weibo is in its decline because of this competition. And they were lamenting Weibo's decline due to this technology and also due to the competition of these new platforms. But more importantly, these heightening censorship on Weibo. So that is why I spend, well, some time in my book to describe some recent changes that Weibo is making. So from basically a news medium to a different one. So from this news medium that is more susceptible to censorship, to something that is more, something that is safer, something that facilitates, for example, the exchange of information about startups, about entrepreneurship, about entertainment, sports, things like that. So that would give Weibo a different look in the future.
Eileen, it's been a fascinating and very insightful discussion. Eileen, thank you very much for talking to us today.
Thank you for having me.